right, then we'll move to the next matter on calendar, which is our Martin Leon Briviesca versus Jeffrey Rosen, case number 17-73108. Each side has 10 minutes. So I guess originally, you were going to be Sara Byram on the first one, but now you're still going to be again Erica Miles, I guess. So we have you on the first two.
Actually, that was the last one. I was a substitute for Sara Byram on the last.
So you're going
case.
To be yourself on both of them.
I'm myself on this one too.
Okay. Well, welcome back. You look familiar. All right. So we'll start with is it Mr. Berkey?
Second D is silent, Your Honor.
So okay. So Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
You can proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Robert Burke, B-E-R-K-E, second D silent, for the respondent, for the petitioner, Martin Leon Briviesca. Your Honors, even though my brief goes a little bit of a different direction than what we just heard, I think he argued those issues great, I'd like to adopt them. I think that my position on this case actually gives the court the opportunity to adopt SORA and still find that 273 A sub A is not a categorical match. And it has to do with the fact that SORA does not change the board's definition, which still requires that there be intentionality, knowingness, recklessness, criminal negligence, in the act that constitutes maltreatment of the child. So what we have when we're looking at the California statute and you take out all the ors and just boil it down to prong two, what it says is any person who under circumstances or conditions likely to produce great bodily harm or death. And Your Honor, I apologize for this from the bottom of my heart. I neglected to ask if I could reserve 2 minutes.
Oh, sure. No, you don't have to go to the bottom of your heart on that. That's okay.
Somewhere in the middle. So if we read that, you know, with all the, you know, orders taken out of it, what we have with prong two is any person who under circumstances or conditions likely to produce great bodily harm or death inflicts thereon, with the parentheticals noted in, I believe, the Sargent case, inflicts thereon, meaning the child, unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering shall be punished. So if we look at that clause one, under circumstances or conditions likely to produce great bodily harm or death, that's a factual, that's not a knowledge, that's not an intent, that's not a scienter, that's not knowing that such circumstances. It's just
factually your case is different in the sense that something actually happened to the minor in yours, correct? I mean, it's not a situation where nothing happened in the as in the other situation where luckily the kids weren't killed when the father was drunk driving, but here something actually happened.
Something happened. Yes. Now I'm not arguing, and I'm not going to stand here and argue, but I'm also not conceding the point. This was a 17-year-old, you know, person. I don't think it has anything to do with anything. My case differs because there was an actual physical contact. Absolutely. And for purposes of this argument, I concede the point. But again, yes, here we do have that prong too. Not that it matters because we're dealing with a categorical approach. But here we do have this prong too that says when it's direct infliction, there's no place within this statute where anything rising to intentional, knowing, reckless, or criminal negligent act or omission comes up. So what we have is we have a general intent. Now, yes, there's the case, there's the Valdez case, and I did hear, you know, counsel for the government mention it in the prior argument, but the Valdez case is talking about those prongs that have willful, and I could even highlight something as she was saying it, on Valdez, where it says, you know, Sargent expressly left open the question of the appropriate mens rea for indirect infliction of harm on the child. But it actually, you know, within Valdez, it says, we're not reversing Sargent. We're not changing our mind about Sargent.
So, but how does that, well, so how does the mens rea required by California Penal Code 273AA differ from that required in the common law and federal definitions of criminal negligence? So how does it differ?
Because it explicitly doesn't require criminal negligence, right? So criminal negligence requires some, at least subjective appreciation of some kind of an object, you know, some kind of a risk that's going on. In fact, Sargent really beautifully talks about exactly what the state of California thinks of criminal negligence. And I'm going to quote, and I love this. I don't have to argue. I can quote. Criminal negligence is aggravated, culpable, gross, or reckless. That is such a departure from what would be the conduct of an ordinary, prudent, or careful person under the same circumstances as to be incompatible with it. That's criminal negligence. I love, and I honestly, you know, it's my, you know, I don't remember which of the cases, but it involved the dad throwing the baby up in the air, and there was the allegation, oh, he was, you know, shaking baby syndrome, and he knew. And, you know, he's saying, no, I was playing with the kid. I threw him up in the air, you know. But in the bottom line, you know, that's a direct infliction. The question comes down to, or would have come down to, did he have, you know, some sense that, wow, this is some kind of a dangerous activity that I'm doing? And the court says, you know what, doesn't matter. It absolutely doesn't matter. A jury can find, as a matter of fact, whether he knew or not, that this is a circumstance that could produce, you know, great bodily harm, and injury was inflicted.
Let me ask you, I want to take you to another area so you can reserve time for rebuttal, but sure. I think that with the appellee in this case asserts that Leon Brevesca did not raise his void for vagueness argument before the BIA and therefore may not raise it before us. Is this true that he did not raise his void for vagueness argument before the BIA? And if so, why isn't he barred from raising it in the Ninth Circuit?
So a couple of answers to that. The void for vagueness argument, obviously, you know, we're asserting it didn't come up until we had DiMaia. Obviously, we're challenging, you know, this statute. And, you know, if we look at it from a perspective of the only reason we're here with three different briefs and three different cases is because Congress passed a law that literally makes no sense from an objective level. It needs all of this input from all of these places. So I think as a general level, it's preserved. But again, we felt, you know, DiMaia kind of changed it. It was impossible to raise it before DiMaia came out. That having been said, Your Honor, and I'm kind of loath to admit it because it's not necessarily, you know, procedurally a way that I love that we took. After the government responded and said, hey, man, you know, this wasn't raised below, we did a sua sponte, for what it's worth with the new regulation now. We did a sua sponte motion to reopen to raise the issue that was actually still pending, but we know where it's going. So I would say, you know, that as a general concept, you know, as a general proposition, the government was at least on notice that we thought there was an issue with the clarity of this particular statute they're trying to enforce. That notwithstanding, it would have been impossible to raise it below because it didn't become ripe until DiMaia. And then as a third thing, we're kind of trying to raise it now, which may be self-defeating on the first two arguments that I made.
All right, so you're at basically at 2 minutes. Do you want to reserve?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. Miles.
Good morning again, Your Honors. I'm Erica Miles for the United States Attorney General. To first address the question about counsel's argument that this statute does not meet the board's definition because a mens rea of general intent, which, you know, falls under that second prong of the 273AA statute about inflicting thereon unjustifiable harm, that is a general intent to commit the offense. So there is a mens rea. In fact, the Sargent case made that, held that in that case, and then it was repeated by the Supreme Court in Valdez that for direct acts falling under this prong, there is a general intent, and that intent is to commit the act. Nothing more is required under the board's definition. The board's definition's mens rea is tethered only to the act or omission. It is not tethered to the circumstances or the resultant maltreatment. It is not tethered to the child element. The mens rea that are outlined, intentional, knowing, reckless, criminal negligence, are modifying only act or omission. And this is borne out in matter of sorum when at the end of that decision, the board concludes that the Colorado statute meets its definition. It says because it requires, it meets the mens rea, it, and as to the act, and there is a juvenile status of the child, showing that the mens rea is tethered to the act, and then you have the status of the child, and then you had the likelihood of harm in that case to the child, which met the maltreatment prong or the impairment prong. So this is separate. So under counsel's argument, I agree the general intent, and it is borne out by California Supreme Court cases, that general intent is an intent to do the act that then ends up harming the child, creating that unjustifiable pain or suffering to a child. And additionally, then you have a separate element, that infliction, that intent to do the act that is infliction of harm, is done under circumstances likely to cause great bodily injury or death of a child. So you have a mens rea with an intent to do an act, and then you have the maltreatment being that act, infliction of suffering under circumstances likely to cause great bodily injury or harm. It falls squarely within the board's definition. The mens rea requirement under the board's definition requires nothing more than a mens rea as to the act or omission.
Can you remind me?
Yes. Oh, go ahead.
I just have a quick question. Have we held that this subsection A offense, have we held whether it's divisible or not?
No, because I believe in front of this court it's come up again as whether or not it categorically matches. Because every conduct on the board has repeatedly said, and this court has looked at repeatedly, that all conduct and all mens rea under this statute meet the board's definition. So there's never been a divisibility challenge that I am aware of, much less reached.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Is there anything, okay, this is factually, obviously the facts are different in this case, and it's a completely different situation where you've got a pastor molesting a parishioner. Is there anything about the facts in this case that change your argument? Or are
No.
you making the same argument on this case as the last case?
I'm making the same argument because we, as this court well knows, are in the universe of categorically matching the statute of conviction, not conduct, not what happened in any given case. What is the statute of conviction, 27AA? What is the board's definition? And you are confined to matching those elements and nothing more.
So really, from your perspective, the facts don't matter here.
The facts cannot matter under Supreme Court law. I would like them to, but they don't, unfortunately, and I fully admit that.
What about the void for vagueness argument? That, can you respond to that?
Yes. Response is, it has no place before this court where the case law has unfolded. And my reason for saying that is because he does not say that the statutory term is vague. He does not say that the term a crime of child abuse, child neglect, or child abandonment is vague. He instead, this court has determined that is ambiguous, every court, even the 10th, that doesn't defer. The 10th has said it's ambiguous, and they've moved on to Chevron Step 2. Every court agrees we're under Chevron Step 2, and the analysis is for reasonableness. There's no place for a void for vagueness challenge under Chevron Step 2, and this court said it in its en banc decision, and Morales it's Morales, and it repeated it in Valenzuela Gallardo. It first said it in Morales is Quidero. Pardon me, I had to look for the full name. Chevron, there are no void for vagueness challenges when you're in Chevron Step 2. Primarily, that's my argument. But secondarily, what he's taking issue with is the board giving meaning to a very narrow standard. After interpreting the statute and narrowing it from abuse, neglect, abandonment, giving very explicit examples of that it must be maltreatment and impairment, what types are maltreatment and impairment, including all of these sexual offenses and exploitation, then the board also said part of maltreatment, a subset of maltreatment, includes endangerment type offenses, but only if there's a sufficiently high risk of harm. That, but only, that very, very, very narrow standard that the board said for endangerment types offenses is what counsel is trying to now say is void for vagueness. And this is the opposite of vagueness, what the board has been doing with the statutory term time and again. You know, the board has narrowed it, was very verbose in its first decision about what is child abuse, neglect, and abandonment. And then it provided even more guidance and authority and for an ordinary person to understand what could possibly get them removed for an offense called child abuse, child neglect, or child abandonment. An ordinary person is on notice that harm, that crimes involving children that harm or might harm them could possibly get them removed.
Are you saying that he's wrong on the void for vagueness, but he hasn't waived it? It wasn't waived.
He did not raise it below. So I guess the argument was technically an exhaustion argument because he raised it here. He should have raised it below, and he actually did, like he said, through his motion to reopen. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is a constitutional question invoking due process, and the board is not necessarily within its authority to decide those issues. So if properly raised, and if this court's precedent allows for it, then it could be raised before this court for the first time. But for the reasons I said about precedent foreclosing it, given that we are squarely within Chevron Step 2, I say that precedent forecloses the argument because it is very clear that this is not a vague term. It's ambiguous. So under Chevron Step 2, you analyze what the board has done and whether or not it's reasonable. And this court has already deferred to that definition as being reasonable and should continue to do so.
Is there a reason, just questioning in terms of, because Cedillo, that decision was vacated, is there a reason to publish on any of these cases, or are, in from your perspective, do you believe these cases just rely on Ninth Circuit precedent, even though Cedillo was vacated?
I think it depends on how the court wants to decide these cases. And the next case is an interesting case because it involves a sexual nature offense, specifically that statute, and there's a different rub there. But we definitely think that we would benefit from having a published decision back on the books about whether or not element of injury is required, because we see these challenges over and over. We have so many briefs before the court right now trying to dispel the notion that an additional element of proof of actual injury is required, because that's how petitioner's counsel keeps reading the Fregoso decision. So it would be helpful to have precedent saying that the board is reasonable in not requiring proof of actual injury, and that the board is reasonable in interpreting the statutory term of abuse, neglect, abandonment as including some endangerment type offenses where the risk of harm to a child is sufficiently high.
All right, thank you. Do either of my colleagues have any questions?
No.
All right. Mr. Burke, we're back to you for your rebuttal.
For the first time in my life, Your Honor, I don't think I'm going to need all 2 minutes. I almost feel like I agree with everything the government attorney said, that it requires a mens rea for the act or omission. And we know what mens rea is required because it's right there in Velazquez-Hernandez, and it ain't in the California statute, at least as relates to prong two. So with that, I submit. I would thank counsel for the appellee for pointing out that, yes, it's the vagueness argument is a constitutional one, and the board might not have the expertise on that anyway. But those two points having been made on my part, I'm prepared to submit.
And right, thank you.
My colleague who's following.
Do either of my colleagues have any questions? We don't appear to. So thank you both for your argument in this matter. This case will stand submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.